Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey everybody, this week we're joined by Rhiannon Payne. She's the CEO and founder of Seafoam Media and Technology, a San Francisco-based studio that's working with blockchain, AI, and other emerging tech companies with end-to-end editorial, design, and engineering services. Rhiannon, thanks for joining us this week. Why don't you just tell us a bit more about yourself, your past ventures, and why you got into the blockchain business?
Yeah, thank you so much, Colton, for having me. I appreciate it. So I actually started Seafoam at mid to the end of 2017. We actually started by working with a large AI company based out of Dublin, Ireland. They were our first client, and some of the work we did for them was actually manual data annotation to help them get through their Series B fundraise. So I had a team of 20 people that I hired globally, basically sorting through and tagging images around the clock to help the company train their AI models. So, you know, after a few months, we were able to successfully help them get through their raise. And from there, we actually took an interesting pivot to blockchain just because it's something I've been very interested in for a long time. It's something that, you know, the kind of ethos of decentralization is something that really resonates with me. And, you know, there's just, especially at the time, such a huge demand in the industry that it made a lot of sense for us to go in that direction.
Interesting. The way that you got your start, I have a mentor who is just this brilliant man. He's in his early 80s and, you know, he was sending me this article saying, hey, why haven't you put something together where you basically get people in the Philippines or elsewhere, Vietnam or whatever, who are going to go and tag all this stuff for this machine learning process? I don't know, man. That sounds like a pain in the ass. I'm sure someone's doing it and making money. That sounds like a lot of work.
Right. It is actually a pain in the ass. but it wasn't so bad. We had a lot of fun. I think that the culture that we were able to cultivate with the team of curators made it a little bit more enjoyable. It was super collaborative and, you know, we had our processes super well-defined and a lot of documentation. So it was really easy just bringing new curators into the team and having them get started. And there was a great support system for, you know, the curators as well and the community. So it was actually, it's not the most exciting work in the world, thus our pivot, but it was actually a lot of fun and a cool experience.
That is cool. And someone has to do it. So it's a good thing that you guys were. Now, you mentioned that you have this belief in the ethos of decentralization and Seafoam is a globally distributed team. So, you know, what benefits has that offered and what does it do to benefit your clients? And, you know, maybe there are some challenges in there too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I started a company remotely with a global team, it was something that was just very natural and intuitive for me because it's something that I've been doing since 2011. You know, one of the things that's very interesting for me about what I call like the new distributed workforce when we look to the next decade and the way work and business is going to be changing in the 20s and beyond that, we're seeing more and more companies, including big companies like GitHub and Amazon, move to partially, if not fully, remote teams. So it's exciting for me to be on the forefront of that. And as far as the ethos surrounding that, I am very passionate about things like elevating emerging markets and giving more opportunities to people globally, which I think is something you can relate to working in the Philippines as well, Colton. And, you know, we have a team spread out across London, all over North America, Nepal, the Philippines, Bali as well. So, you know, it's been a lot of fun. I haven't necessarily found there to be too many challenges. Obviously, the, you know, management of work across time zones, especially, you know, when you compare San Francisco to Nepal, which is, you're looking at almost polar opposites there, but you just have to be flexible. And we have an amazing project manager in the Philippines who, you know, is able to help us coordinate things. So it's all about having great project management processes in place and, you know, again, being quite nimble and willing to, you know, get on and do scrums at weird hours. So I think that it's provided a lot of benefits for us in that kind of the company culture and community that we've created is, you know, very open and honest and collaborative. And I find that to be, you know, even more prevalent in remote distributed work environments. Just because I don't know, it's interesting because a lot of people have this assumption that you can communicate and collaborate better when you're working with an office with someone, you know, 9 to 5, and you're able to sit down and just like shoot the shit and whiteboard and, you know, take lunch breaks together. And I found that to be true to a degree, but I think that, you know, there's a lot of people, especially in tech, who are more introverted or who maybe struggle with social anxiety, and being able to work remotely kind of opens up a way to communicate more honestly and be much more intentional with your communications. So it's definitely benefited us. And I think that, you know, having our resources distributed in so many different locations and time zones definitely benefits our clients as well, in that, you know, we can send a project to design, you know, at 6 o'clock our time here in San Francisco. And by the time we wake up in the morning, we have a deliverable to show the client. So, you know, we keep those iteration loops really tight. And we always have, you know, coverage somewhere. So I think that's a great benefit to everyone involved.
Absolutely. It seems like it would have to be. And I've worked in distributed organizations before, and it was actually not difficult to stay in touch with people, develop a sort of friendly relationship. It's not the same as having worked in an office environment where everyone's right there every day. So you kind of get maybe like work friends, so to speak, but you also tend to get people that you maybe don't feel such friendly feelings toward too. And that's a lot harder to have happen in a remote team as well. So generally there's actually a nice kind of balance where they're not really part of your personal life so much. And so it's easy to get along for an extended period of time without any issues. But, you know, as you mentioned, the introverted people, I've been both in life. I wouldn't really say I'm one or the other, but I can definitely say with some degree of shame, there were years when I was in high school where most of my like really in-depth friendships where we're exchanging lots of ideas, and you know, all this was happening over the internet. I moved a lot. People I didn't even meet. One guy who became one of my best friends, we communicated entirely over the internet for 8 years, ended up trying to go into business together later on, which was a story of its own. But, you know, it's amazing how people can actually connect and do work together online these days, and you don't need to have met in person. So
absolutely. I think that speaks so much to our generation too, because I had an extremely similar experience in like middle school and high school, where, you know, I was just dealing with like, you know, crippling social anxiety and really had a hard time integrating like at high school and, you know, doing well in that environment for that reason. And being able to forge these like online friendships and collaborations just opened up so many doors and was so inspiring for me.
Yeah, it's really kind of an interesting process, because when I got to college, for instance, I thought, well, enough of this, you know, I'm going to become much more social, and went out of my way to, you know, throw parties and do all the crazy stuff. But I found that I had a ton of acquaintances then, but I didn't really have any kind of depth of conversation with them. And I looked back fondly on being 14, 15, whatever, and trying to make some kind of, you know, indie video game with some people I met on a forum all over the world. And that has its own value. So you mentioned your company culture, and I'm curious, because you've talked about part of the way that you value working with people from all over the world is that they do have those different perspectives. Do you think that the company culture and finding people who fit that supersedes any challenges that might arise from differences in just local cultures?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there hasn't been a single person that we've introduced to the team where there hasn't been, you know, kind of a perspective fit. And that's, you know, one of the reasons for that is that my business partner, Justin Bowen, and I both have been able to bring a lot of our team members from previous projects with us to Seafoam. So, you know, these are people that we already have great working relationships with, who we trust, and, you know, whose skill sets we've already validated, and who we also have friendships with. I don't, you know, if I'm working with someone to any degree, it's really hard for me to not form some kind of personal relationship or friendship with them, you know, for better or worse. I haven't, you know, encountered any problems with that so far. But, you know, I take a very people-first approach. And I think that as we brought on, you know, even more team members who, you know, we haven't necessarily worked with in the past, I think that, you know, it's just kind of been the ways in which I've gone about finding talented people. I often pull people from, you know, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Telegram groups that I'm in, where there's already a like-minded community there full of talented people. And, you know, being able to bring people from those groups, like there's a group on Facebook that I've been in for years called Female Digital Nomads. And, you know, it's just a group of 50,000 women who work remotely or want to start working remotely and like to travel while working. So we've brought on 5 team members from that group. And, you know, it's just like, it instantly clicks like, okay, you have a similar outlook on life as I do. And so it's really easy to start collaborating and working together, and, you know, it becomes kind of seamless.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely, you know, great advice. And for those that are listening to this, if you're having trouble finding good hires for your team, or you're looking for partners, you're looking for even just somebody to set up a meetup with, because that's what I've been looking at doing all evening. Mm-hmm. That kind of pre-filtering based on associations can save you a lot of time and wasted energy. So, you know, that's a great one. But I know that when I sent over the kind of outline before the call here, I'd asked for just some recommendations for the listeners, you know, if they're going to go and try to build a remote organization, or they have one and they want to improve it. If you want to just recap those now, I think that'd be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think obviously finding the right people is key, finding those organizations that you can tap into, and creating the right project management processes, which is something that, you know, as we scaled up really quickly, because it's, you know, been a year and a half now, not even for Seafoam, and we're up to 20 people. So it can be really easy to get underwater. So, you know, creating the right practices from the beginning, I think, is key. You know, using tools like Trello, for instance, which is super flexible. It's something that a lot of people use, and we use it for a variety of things, including managing our sales funnel, so that we can scale our resources up and down more easily, along with, you know, the new clients and projects that we bring on. So that's something that's been really key for us. You know, having, if you do have a distributed team, having people who, like project management, where you can provide coverage, you know, virtually around the clock, having great documentation. And when I was doing some of that data curation work, when I was leading that team, you know, we had people in New Zealand, people in North America, people in Europe. So it was really pivotal, especially as, you know, there was a need to move really, really fast and scale up quickly as well in that situation. So, you know, instead of doing individual training sessions on Skype or Uber conference every time we brought a new curator on, you know, creating good documentation, like screen recordings of how to use the curation software, and written documentation, like this is an example of, you know, good data. This is an example of what bad data looks like. And, you know, not only having that, but creating the kind of community where it's, you know, an environment where people feel comfortable working together and asking questions. So that's really allowed us to scale more efficiently.
Gotcha. So just processes and documentation and good onboarding, good project management, tracking, using things like Slack, Trello, that all integrates nicely. You know, it's not even a difficult task anymore. Mm-hmm. For snap together. So that's really cool. And having pivoted to the blockchain space for a number of reasons, I know that you're really interested in the tokenization of assets, the kind of digital security token ecosystem that is rapidly developing, not just in the United States, but globally. So how do you see your company participating in that? How would you like to participate in that in 2019? Tell us more about your plans there.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, we started getting into the blockchain stuff at the end of 2017, which was kind of the height of the hype for ICOs. And it was a really exciting time. And there were all these great projects that were raising money and, super excited about all of these fantastic new ideas. But as we watched over the next 6 months, it became clear that the ICO and the utility token were not really an ideal method of fundraising. And not only were investors losing out because of this, but, you know, good teams and good companies with legitimately good ideas and intentions were also, you know, losing out because they weren't, you know, the ICO, you know, wasn't really setting them up for success either. So, you know, around June of last year, we started learning more about security tokens and looking at that space more seriously at the recommendation of one of our legal partners here in the U.S. And it, you know, it started becoming clear very quickly that this is going to be the future of, you know, the overall industry and fundraising on blockchain. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. You still kind of have the greater distribution power and potential for greater liquidity that ICO fundraising brings. But you have that added layer of regulation on top of that. And this may be controversial just because there's a lot of people in the community that still think that any regulation is a bad thing. But, you know, after everything that happened 17 and 2018, I think that as far as just the reputation of the industry and people's willingness to engage with these projects and invest early on, whether that's, you know, non-accredited investors like myself or, you know, more serious institutional investors, I think that that regulation is much needed to get people to, you know, remain excited about the stuff going on in the blockchain space and wanting to be a part of that. So, you know, we're not working with any ICO projects, and we're working with a variety of up and coming STOs and, STO platform offerings as well. So that's been really exciting for us. And I think, you know, as CFOAM, we want to be on the forefront of that as the floodgates kind of open later this year, as you see, you know, players like T0 and Coinbase launching their alternative trading systems, at some point this year. I don't think there's a firm date on that, but we want to be part of providing education to our clients and our community. We're doing some thought leadership stuff on Medium right now with the CFOAM blog, and we want to keep doing really other really cool stuff as well. I love what you're doing, for instance, with the podcast. So we're just exploring more opportunities to be, you know, part of that as this industry really takes off.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I had just spoken with Graham Moore at Polymath the other day, and that one of the things we talked about was what you mentioned there in terms of the regulation. It's not so much wanting to get into the weeds, the philosophy of the debate, but just if we wanted to go anywhere right now without it being bogged down and stopped and halted altogether, then if you're going to be doing something that's pretty much, let's say, intended for mass market or it's intended for mainstream news, there's always going to be projects like Monero, like the various different privacy-centric things that are happening out there, and anybody can go and use those, and that's really cool that they exist. But for those who actually want to go through a more traditional process that the government and the banks are going to actually smile upon. That's also something that they're able to do. And that's really cool thing about this technology or this whole field is that there's really not one right or way wrong, or right or wrong way, excuse mm-hmm. me. So
yeah, what, absolutely.
What I'm really interested to see is how each one of those two divergent paths develop and mature and how they also kind of reconverge later under different circumstances.
Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing too right now is as far as blockchain technology is concerned, I think using blockchain and tokenization as a vehicle for raising funds is huge and very revolutionary and something practical that we're seeing implemented right now, as opposed to a lot of these more blue sky ideas related to, you know, applications of blockchain tech. So I think it's something where there's a real need, and we can see, you know, a potential future where all stocks, bonds, and equity is actually being traded on blockchain through tokenization. So it's something real. It's something where there's a need. It's something we can do right now. And I don't think there's a lot of use cases like that. So it's something that really excites me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And one of the other things that we touched upon, and what I think you and I even might have spoken about recently, was that it's, if you look at it from the perspective of you really liked ICOs for what they were or are, and you see the STO as being compared to the ICO, then it would suck. You know, it's like, oh man, now there's KYC. You have to be accredited, and you know, you have to go and get all this stuff and make sure you're complying with some regulations or some exemptions. And it basically just sucks for all the reason traditional finance sucks. But if you look at it from the traditional side and you don't compare it to the ICO, but you compare it to the way things have been done, it's actually a massive improvement in efficiency, cost reduction, accessibility for a lot of people. So in that case, it's a massive leap technologically. So I think it kind of just depends on which direction they're coming from. And that might be where some of the debate is maybe almost a misunderstanding of the conflict, and they're not really being one at all.
Yeah, I think that's really well said too. And it does depend on where you're coming from. I think there's, you know, very clear pros and cons to each approach. But for me, you know, looking at this industry, I tend to be more pragmatic as opposed to, you know, more of a crypto anarchist. So that's kind of my approach. And I think that as these processes and the technology becomes better defined and, you know, people are adopting it more, we can, you know, imagine a future where there is a lot more disruption, but it has to catch on first. And for it to do that, I think it has to be done in such a way where it's easier for the average person to understand and want to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I would have to say that I'm probably on both sides of that fence, depending, you know, if I'm in the gathering place of good ideas, the pub, you know, then I'm very crypto anarchist in my leanings. But when I'm on LinkedIn, I'm very pragmatic. You know? So
right.
I think you have also an interesting balance that you've struck between media and tech at Seafoam. So I know that your partnership within the company and then the partnerships that you've structured with other businesses, it kind of allows you to have both of those sides. So tell us about that, the balance between media and tech at Seafoam.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that, you know, over the past year, we've really been, you know, working to find a way to bring those pieces together in a seamless fashion and find the right way to, you know, communicate who we are and what we do to people, just because, you know, the media and the tech side almost feel like such disparate pieces. And, you know, that kind of came from, you know, me starting the company. I started Seafoam by writing marketing white papers for blockchain and AI projects. And, you know, within a month of starting that, we started scaling. It was pretty much instantaneous. And it wasn't necessarily a plan of mine for that to be the case. It just happened because that's this industry that we're in, and that demand is real. So We started scaling, and I was very lucky that there was an opportunity for me to bring in, my longtime business partner, Justin Bowen, into the mix as well. And Justin and I have worked on projects together for years now. We actually were two co-founders of a software company a few years back based in Tokyo. And we got to work together in Tokyo building a product for hotels like the Ritz-Carlton and the Grand Hyatt. And, that was just an incredible life-changing experience. So, having, him on his side getting into blockchain as well and starting to explore that and being able to bring in his engineering and design team into the mix, we kind of had the thought, why not make this an end-to-end agency? Why not, have this kind of like end-to-end experience for our clients? So, that was super incredible and lucky for me to be able to put those pieces together. But then it comes down to, okay, how do we communicate that? And, not only how do we communicate that, but what's our overall business strategy in connecting these pieces? And as things started to play out, we realized that it made so much sense for us to take a client in, a very early stage, and for Justin and I to actually work together in creating their white paper, creating their investor deck, doing their branding and their landing page and this whole package that we offer for early stage companies. And having his involvement from the very beginning, he's able to help them figure out, okay, what are we communicating in these materials from a technical perspective and from a user experience perspective, figuring out kind of fundamental architecture and user experience behind what you want to build. How do we take an idea that's more blue sky and communicate it in a more practical way technologically and develop a roadmap that really makes sense to people? So he's been involved in those, those white papers and stuff very early stage alongside me. And, then once that client starts to, seek fundraising, it only makes sense for them to come back to us and be like, hey, you helped us define what we're doing. We'd love to work with you on actually building out our MVP as well. So that's kind of been our strategy. And what we're looking at now is, helping these early stage clients, getting their materials together, introducing them to the right investor relationships groups that we work with, and then working with them on the tech side as well and forging these very long-term trusted relationships.
Yeah, that's great. To have the ability to have the tech and the media side of things involved in the same process from the outset is, at first to me, it was kind of like, okay, that's cool that they do both. But having thought about it and, the way you just described it, that addresses one of the major problems, even within larger organizations where they have both of those departments in-house and they're not necessarily using agencies. They don't communicate particularly well. Historically, it's a major challenge and disconnect, if not rivalry and mutual loathing. So,
absolutely.
Making promises that seem completely disconnected from reality, and then the engineering side being just loathed by everybody for constantly being late, because they unrealistic promises. So you guys are sitting there and actually figuring out from the very beginning, is this doable? Is it even desirable? Do people even want this? Will they use it this way? And then keeping it well enough on track, managing the client expectations. So in working that out, have you had any, experiences that you would chalk up to just learning the hard way, or has it all been pretty much smooth sailing?
Well, it definitely hasn't, just been smooth sailing. There's definitely been some hard-earned lessons, and, that kind of trial and error and learning those hard lessons has, been something that's really defined my career from the beginning is, building a team and staying lean and scrappy and figuring things out and learning as we go. I think we're finally starting to see, over a year in now, that strategy that I just spoke of coming to fruition, because one of our very first clients, was a group out of Chicago who is in the rare coins and antiquities industry. And I think they were maybe our second or third client. And I wrote their white paper and I was so excited at the time, you know, when we signed them on, I was like, yes, you know, one of our first white paper contracts, and really got to do a deep dive into their industry and, you know, deliver this great product to them. And I didn't at that point even imagine it was going to go anywhere from there, just because, you know, at the beginning, we didn't realize what was going to happen. And, you know, not only as far as Seafoam and our growth, but, you know, the industry as a whole. And from there, we were really able to build on that relationship. And, you know, now that has come to fruition in that we're starting to work on a huge technology build for them. Actually creating a Hyperledger-based platform for their community of rare art and antiquities and coin collectors and enthusiasts to use their own coin to be able to trade in these rare assets and create kind of a central hub for the community to not only buy, sell, and trade, but be social as well and have all of these transactions recorded on a ledger and having each of these rare items actually serialized on the blockchain. So, you know, it's such a great use case in this relationship, and even their whole vision for the product has changed and evolved so much since the beginning. So, you know, I think that's a great example of, you know, how we've kind of figured it out as we've gone.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, it's obviously a process. I've been involved with some interesting startup situations in the past where it seemed like never ending soul crushing scope creep. And if you've survived all of that, then more power to you. So now I have to ask a question that just came to mind. As somebody who's written a lot of white papers, how do you honestly feel about reading them?
Right. It depends on the project, and, you know, it depends on, I think, the writer who created it as well, because a lot of them are very dry, and even the best ideas, if they're not communicated in a compelling manner, can fall really flat. So, you know, again, it really, really depends. We try to write white papers in such a way where, you know, we do kind of try to hook the reader from the beginning, whether that's, you know, an investor or, you know, someone in the community who's just curious, and, you know, get them excited about the project, as opposed to just, you know, here's a document that we're going to have just for the sake of having a document. Right. So people can download the PDF and see that it's 40 pages long and be like, okay, well, they wrote 40 pages. They must be doing something, but not actually want to read it. So, you know, it's not like a lot of companies, they're kind of creating a white paper just to have something to put on their site. But we, you know, hope that people are actually reading these documents. And you know, that they're getting excited about these projects that we work on.
That's good. That's very good, because I read quite a few of them. And one of the great things about this podcast is, fortunately, a lot of my guests are they're in some service delivery or consulting or media or whatever. So they're not necessarily coming from the tech angle. And those that are, I do read the white papers. So if you're listening to this, yes, I do read the white papers. It's where I get a lot of my questions from. And for the record, if you're listening and you've been on the show, then I love your white paper. But for everybody else, when I read them, I wish it was either very technical and very dry, but just highly detailed and it all makes sense. I'm okay with that. I'll set aside the time, make a cup of coffee, and at least, okay, I've learned something. This is a fascinating concept. But if you're white paper is just propaganda, then at least hire a good copywriter. Because worse than 30 or 40 pages of terrible copy that's just, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. Like, okay, yeah, but why? So hopefully.
Exactly. And that's actually really funny too, that you mentioned the technical side of that. Just because when I started writing these, our CTO, Justin, kind of, you know, he comes from a very technical background. Obviously, he reads a lot of technical documents all the time in his work, and he just kind of laughed a little bit, like, this isn't what a white paper is supposed to be. Like, a traditional white paper for anything outside of blockchain is a technical document. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, well, maybe you can help us bridge the gap here, like create, you know, technical parts of this paper to provide value on that side and help synthesize the technical details for, you know, someone, anyone to understand it, whether they're a technologist or not. And again, that comes back to kind of combining our expertise to make these really fully fleshed out documents.
That's good. I find that interesting. I'm kind of curious to see how the whole concept and execution of the white paper evolves over the next couple of years, you know, with companies like yours and then others that are doing similar things, because it is a nice balance to have some kind of compelling copy, really, like, just calling it what it is, but also having that technical element there where what's being explained is being explained well, and it's not something that you could just go copy and paste off of any site, slap it in there. So that stuff, right, it's kind of a boring part of due diligence that I don't really think a lot of people do. If we're talking about a lot of people, meaning just every Joe out there who goes and wanted to get some kind of airdrop or bounty or whatever. And I mean, I kind of came into this a little bit ignorant, thinking that most people are relatively sophisticated or they wouldn't be paying attention to this very niche, bizarre kind of nerds focus. And then it turns out there's just these millions and millions of people in these Telegram groups that are really just kind of clueless. And if you're listening and you're that,
right,
like, hey, it's calling me clueless, then yes, it's you. I'm talking about you. So be careful.
I mean, people realize there's money here. There's money to be made. And you see a lot of these business guys who have been involved in fintech for a while being like, okay, you know, here's an opportunity. You see $13 billion flooding into this brand new sector and this brand new method of fundraising. And it's like, okay, you have my attention. Maybe I'm not a technologist, but I'm going to find a way to take advantage of this. So, you know, we now have a lot of that.
Well, and God bless those. You know, if they have a fintech background or they've been involved on some level professionally, whether it's from the tech or from the finance side, whatever it is, that's great. I was just shocked by the amount of people who otherwise would probably just be like on a Discord chat for some game that they're into. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just very kind of random people. And that, I guess on one hand, it's cool because it's, hey, the whole mass adoption thing, buzzword of the year. On the other hand, it's also alarming to an extent, something, how much money do these people put into these different tokens? And maybe that's why you have, you know, the SEC. I've had a lot of just weird cognitive dissonance going on since seeing these people, like, hey, I spent, you know, X amount of dollars on this 6 months ago. How come the team's not answering? Oh boy.
Yeah.
So you,
and that goes back to the problems inherent in a lot of these ICOs. So.
Yeah. So you have set up some good partnerships for Seafoam external to the company, brand partnerships, relationships, you know, service integrations. Could you tell us a bit about those and why they've worked out well for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've met a lot of different people in 2018 and, explored partnership opportunities. And the biggest thing that we found is it's great to work with honest, I mean, obviously this should be a no-brainer, right? Like, honest, reputable people who have had proven success. And, you know, who have worked with other people who you trust or who are obviously legitimate. So at the beginning, it was kind of like, okay, you know, how do we tell who's who? And again, it sounds like a no-brainer, but when you are in a new industry and you have a lot of different people approaching you, you know, with a lot of big ideas and promises and, you know, who you seem to know exactly what they're talking about, it can get a little bit, you know, hard to discern, you know, what kind of people should we be working with and who shouldn't we be working with. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned like hard lessons versus smooth sailing earlier, and that's been, you know, that process has been, you know, definitely full of some of the hard lessons for us. But, you know, as far as partnerships, we found that some of the best collaborations have come from people who provide kind of similar services, but, you know, complementary services. So, like, there's a group out of Austin, Texas called the Decenter Group, who we met in Malta in November of last year. And one of their key offerings, and something that, you know, I haven't seen, you know, necessarily spelled out from some of the other legal firms that we've collaborated with as, you know, a specific line item service, is a legal review of materials like white papers and decks. And, you know, it was so obvious after talking with them and, you know, hearing about some of the clients they've worked with. And once they've let, and they're really, really, you know, great guys who clearly are on the up and up. And it was so obvious, like, okay, well, here we are writing white papers and decks. Let's include your legal review services as a line item there and create like a package together that we can provide clients. So we're giving them, truly providing such great value to our clients by providing something that's truly end to end, which, you know, I think is especially important as we go into this new world of STOs where regulation is everything.
Yeah, that's certainly an interesting challenge, because the quality of the marketing being what it was, and just the sophistication of fraud and just bad actors in general within anything that touches finance is absolutely impressively sophisticated a lot of the times. I mean, the same mentor I mentioned earlier in the call at the beginning, he would keep a just a binder full of things that he'd show me just over the years. He collected samples and he'd put them down before me, like, which one of these do you think was a fraud and which one do you think was a legitimate investment? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, the fraud was the one that was just perfect, glossy, the highest quality that they could get from their local print shop or whatever. It was, it was super slick and it all sounded perfect. But then, you know, that this is what they spent their time and money doing, is duping people. So that's when you go and you set up these kinds of partnerships like you have, and they're able to provide that very necessary legal review, which apparently nobody seemed to care about until losing money, right? Like, who do I sue? Oh, wait, I can't.
I'm getting subpoenaed.
Right. So you've got that in place, and you mentioned a couple here in the notes. Did you want to get into those, or do we have to keep it kind of general and move on?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
As far as the partnerships, I was curious because you listed a couple of notes, and there was just a couple in there, and I wondered if you wanted to talk about them particularly and speak highly of them on the recording, or if we'll
just... Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great.
So there's two in particular. You know, one of the people I've enjoyed working with most over the past year is a woman named Sarah Hanks, who is a DC-based securities lawyer who is former SEC, has been working in securities law for upwards of 30 years now. And she's just, you know, not only incredibly honest and, you know, she's so knowledgeable about her trade. And I think last time I asked her about this, she said that 30 to 40% of her clients, were in the crypto and blockchain space. And I'm sure that's a number that's only grown since then. So she's someone who has been an amazing partner, not just on, you know, from the perspective of referring clients back and forth, but also someone who, you know, if we have a question about something at CFOM, like one of our clients wants to do something where we're not so sure how that would work from a legal perspective, she's one of those people who's always open to, you know, take an email or get on the phone and talk us through something. So that's been super valuable for us, and, you know, definitely respect the hell out of her. And she's just such a, you know, friendly and lovely person too. So that always helps.
That's good.
And another example too of a great partnership has been One World Online, which is a group that a marketing group that specializes in this space. And we were lucky enough to be able to connect with them last August. And it's kind of funny how that worked out, because initially we were brought together by another partner with another group that turned out to, you know, not be a great fit for working with either of us, incidentally. But, you know, Alex at One World and I formed a great relationship, and we're now collaborating on a lot of clients. And I think the cool thing about Alex and his team is that, you know, they've had several successful exits working with a variety of high-tech companies in the past, like smart homes and IoT, and, you know, experienced some really, really cool acquisitions over that time. And then they started One World, and I think it was 2012. So they've been kind of, you know, doing stuff in the marketing world for tech for a while now. Like, they have that proven track record, and they did their own ICO for One World a few years back and successfully. And now they're, you know, creating this amazing platform to help people in this space, you know, raise money. And he's just been, you know, provided so much, similar to Sarah, has been able to provide so much great knowledge and consulting to us as we navigate this, space in Grow Seafoam. And we've been able to collaborate on clients as far as, you know, us providing media and tech services and them providing more on the marketing side. So
great.
That's been a really cool collaboration.
Yeah. So the theme across this, you know, to go off of these, and then the one that you mentioned before, was it Decenter? Can you just repeat that one?
Decentric Group. Yeah.
Decentric
Group.
Okay. That's, if I'm gathering it really, the theme is those who are in the business of helping companies that are in this space actually do things the legit way, which it should go without saying, but we all know that in the blockchain space, it doesn't go without saying. We have to say it. So
right.
It's, something we're learning, and it's sort of like putting your hand on the stove and putting your hand on the stove. If we're going to do this and hold on to the money, hold on to the good news or the good impression that we've got going and that people have gotten started, we're going to have to do things in a way that's respectable and ethical, and taking a long-term view. So short-term, long-term, the year ahead, the kind of partnerships that you might see being most valuable. So either what you're lacking and could really use an introduction, or what is already working for you in that pattern we just mentioned and you want to build on that. What do you see being the best for you the rest of the year?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. We took advantage of the holiday time and the new year as, you know, agency work slowed down to really think, you know, who do we want to be next year as Seafoam? You know, where do we want to be in 2020? Again, we're looking at the start of a whole new decade. And, you know, from where we're positioned now, I think there's so many different paths we can take. I think that not only do we want to keep growing on the agency side, taking on clients who aren't even early stage necessarily, but, you know, later stage companies and even enterprise companies who want to figure out how to integrate blockchain into their existing processes to enhance what they're doing already. You know, we're looking at referral relationships and partnership relationships where, you know, we can obviously refer great clients back and forth and collaborate on clients like we're doing with some of our other partners now, and, you know, start working with larger later stage clients. So partners who can help facilitate that. As well as, you know, we're actually looking at building out several of our own products internally now. There is a product that I'm working on, and we're going to be releasing a beta in April. That will be a blockchain-based platform for people to share resources. So if you think like a startup, like my company, Seafoam, you know, having a platform and a trustless decentralized system to share resources and be able to stay more lean and nimble and scale up and down. And I'd love to talk to you about that more in April once we actually do have that beta live. But, you know, we are also looking for partnerships with people who can help us grow initiatives like that, whether that's, you know, helping us find early stage funding because everything we've been doing up to this point has been 100% bootstrapped. So I'd really like to start accelerating some of, you know, not only what we're doing with Seafoam, but some of these other projects as well. So, you know, people who can help support us, not only with, you know, helping us achieve some early funding, but also, you know, partnerships with other companies that can really enhance these efforts. So,
yeah. Well, speaking of growing initiatives, because I love a good pun, can we just take a moment to talk about GreenThumb.io and how you guys are developing that internally and maybe the overlap with some of the really high tech stuff that you guys have done and worked with, how you're applying that to GreenThumb. And then we can talk a bit about how cannabis and blockchain have a good bit of overlap.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, GreenThumb is a bit different in that there's actually no immediate blockchain play, but, you know, our CTO and my business partner, Justin Bowen, this is a project that he's actually been working on for the past several years now. And what he's built is a system, a smart camera system that can be used in cannabis grow rooms to observe and analyze the growth and health of cannabis plants and report valuable metrics back to the growers. And not only that, but more recently last year, he built an automated dosing system as well. So, you know, this is something he's been testing for a while on his own grow where he's able to remotely observe the health of the plants using the smart cameras and the analytics that are provided. And be able to, right now, as far as the way the platform works now, he's able to remotely trigger actions such as being able to feed the plants or provide more nutrients based on the health of the plants and the data that's been collected. So he's built this really cool system. It's, you know, a passion project for him, and it's something that, you know, ultimately he wants to create this end-to-end automated cannabis cultivation process. And this can be applied to other agriculture as well. We're also testing it on things like microgreens, like broccoli. And, you know, you're applying the same logic to, you know, any kind of grow. So that's been, you know, something amazing to watch as that product has evolved and, you know, where he now has this incredible working beta. So at Seafoam, we want to help him accelerate development of that. So it is, you know, an internal Seafoam product as well, where we're going to be, you know, doing some marketing and PR and, you know, help him get, obtain the funding and he needs to start growing out his team and accelerate what he's doing. He's going to be releasing a web and mobile app later this year for growers. And right now he's looking for partner growers and, you know, obviously investments as well. And he has four team members now based in San Francisco who he's starting to collaborate with next month on the development stuff. So that's all really exciting. And I think long-term too, when you look at compliance, which is especially in California, huge for the cannabis industry, being able to track the plants from seed to sale, what kind of fertilizers are being used on the plants, and being able to track those pieces seed to sale transparently on the blockchain, I think could be really revolutionary for that industry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, the regulatory compliance issue, it also has benefits. Aside from being the pain in the ass that it is, it does have benefits from just a business management perspective and getting it down to the most efficient use of all resources. There's also a potential for the tokenization of assets in that space. I've had conversations with some very interesting gentlemen at Dealbox, and one of their companies that they're working with has... they're doing something in the cannabis space has to do with that stuff. And tokenizing that, whether it's the revenue or the actual company itself, there's so many ways to go about that. And then of course you have the automation, you have the seed to sale. I did a panel related to the security issue. So security in terms of physical security. I think that was 2015. And this was at the Washington Association of Cannabis something. And these were people that were concerned with the lack of security from the state mandated system. So, you know, they basically bought some system from some private company that did kind of a not such a great job. And meanwhile, mm-hmm. the regulations required so much information to be public record that a person could go and look up and with a couple of requests, they could basically figure out the floor plan of the place, where all the security cameras would be, how much money would be there based just estimating the crop cycles, all of it. And they could just rob people transporting massive amounts of cash. And this was when it had just become legalized, had a couple of years, but still there's people driving around massive amounts of cash. We had a situation that a lady talked about. They cut through the side of the warehouse like an electric saw and just went in.
Oh my God.
The guy took out, I think, 23 out of 24 cameras, and then he took his mask off right in front of the last camera. But they still never caught him. You know, it's a ridiculous right. industry. So the more that it can be automated, tokenized, aided by blockchain and automation technology, secured properly, brought down in terms of the cost that it has to bear, and able to access financial services. Fortunately, there are players getting it right all over the place, but there are very, very few who have managed to get it all together in one perfectly functioning system. And even still, that's kind of a tremendous undertaking, whereas maybe 5 years mm-hmm. from now, it'll be like as easy as you and I were talking about setting up a distributed team. It's not necessarily easy, but you can connect mm-hmm. Trello and Slack and whatever CRM system, and you can plug them all together and you can create recordings. 10 years ago, a remote team was substantially more difficult. 10 years before that, super pain in the ass. So we'll get somewhere with it. I want to get back to just very quickly the partnerships issue. And we talked about the benefits and how great it is, but I like to be realistic with people too, because otherwise mm-hmm. it sounds like I'm really hyping something. So let's talk about the risks and the concerns. When you go into these partnership discussions with people this year, based on what you've learned, what are your primary concerns? What are you looking out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have been approaching partnerships much more cautiously based on the lessons of last year. Mm-hmm. And there were a few times where we got screwed over or realized that a partner wasn't who they said they were and didn't have the intentions that they claimed. You know, I think that there's a lot of service providers working to provide tech and media and like white paper services to blockchain companies. But, you know, it's hard to find the right agency to work with and an agency that really gives a shit and really will, you know, give a project their all. And, you know, stay scrappy and, you know, produce the best possible work. And I think a lot of agencies, you know, tend to be, you know, sometimes more complacent. So, you know, when you have a company like Seafoam, where, you know, we're a lot of young people who, you know, are very determined to do the very best work we can. And, you know, we all have, you know, pretty cool backgrounds and experience that allows us to, you know, provide you know, the level of quality that projects in the space really need. There's obviously going to be people who have been around the block a few more times who see mm-hmm. that and see that as something they can take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And again, when you are, you know, younger, you're a younger agency, that's also, you know, a flag where someone says, okay, this is someone who, you know, I could potentially manipulate. Mm-hmm. And that's something we saw a few times last year, unfortunately, where there were groups that seemed really, really legitimate, people who we met in person multiple times here in San Francisco and, you know, who we thought had our best interests at heart, but ultimately they didn't. And, you know, that kind of, you know, shadiness can come in so many different forms. So, you know, it's just a matter of being super cautious. And, you know, when someone approaches us about partnering, you know, going to some of our trusted partners and acquaintances in the industry and being like, hey, have you heard of these guys? Have you worked with them? You know, what do you think? Yeah. You know, that's something we're doing more of, and, you know, getting references and, you know, just being a lot more careful.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's very, very important to remember that one of the worst things is confirmation bias, especially that which preys upon your ego or your insecurities or your desires, preconceived notions about the world in general. The worst kind of most deceptive content on the internet is the stuff that you read and you're instantly like, yeah, I knew it.
Yeah.
Guys, you know, because that was written, I was written to get under your skin and for you to basically agree with it quickly. And so if you somebody wants to sell you a lie, they do is they bury it in a pile of 99% truth and they slip the lie in there and you take it like a dog eating a pill, a nasty pill with a steak that he's getting.
Right.
He loves that
steak. Right.
Little does he know he's eating his medicine. So that's something that we have to be careful of. And the other thing is not just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. If somebody does have something they've been involved with that isn't so great, just note the inconsistency and give them a chance to explain it, but don't put it under the rug. So a great example of this would be if somebody was involved with, say, one ICO out of a bunch that they worked with, because a lot of people were happily calling themselves ICO advisors 5 months ago,
right?
4 months ago, that might be rebranding themselves on LinkedIn now. Totally understandable. If they had one that was called out as being a pretty big scam, it's like, oh man, what happened there, right? How much do you want to take credit for helping raise those funds now versus, you know, where are you at with it? But if someone's got 15, 16 that were called out for being scams and suddenly they've just disappeared and rebranded, that might be one that's a little more concerning, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And anyone has, you know, no matter how experienced you are, anyone has the capacity to be manipulated by a scammer. And it kind of reminds me when you said that of the Fire Festival. And I think everyone's been watching those documentaries on Hulu and Netflix recently. And it just so shocking. And, you know, seeing all these marketing agencies and events agencies and, you know, very professional, legitimate people working alongside them to execute on this vision that was ultimately a total sham. Yeah. You know, that's not to say that all of those agencies and service providers, you know, lack legitimacy too. Maybe some of them, but not necessarily all.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story, isn't it? And the people involved, you know, so many legitimate people involved. One of the most fascinating examples of how you can just be taken in by the idea of something. And I don't think I can really get into the details of it, but the guy, you know, let's just say the star of that story, tried to liquidate his assets through the company I was working with at the time. And then
one
of my coworkers ended up having to talk to the FBI, you know, so I was kind of aware of this dude a while ago and I had exchanged some emails, I think. So I think that's about as much as I can say, but it was really funny to see.
Yeah.
Does he get one documentary? He's in two. So aside from the whole prison thing, he kind of got his wish.
Oh my God.
Famous.
Yeah.
The worst part about
it's a funny thing how social media this whole, you know, society surrounding social media works now.
It's amazing. And I think the best thing about it, well, really the worst, the most damning thing, because I watched both of the documentaries in the same afternoon. I was very shameful. But
I did the same, actually.
Okay, so, you know, I even got a Hulu subscription I need to cancel before it charges me.
Oh, my God.
they
just can't look away.
I know. Well, it's because in one of them, he's on video. They recorded the whole thing, of course, and as they were told to, and he's saying something like, oh yeah, this thing is just to get your average loser guy in America who will never do any of this to sell him a fantasy. And I'm thinking, man, it's just on two levels it's horrible, because on the first level it's sort of just you know, it's so bad to just say it like that. Even if that's what you're really thinking, you got to say something nicer. And then on the second level, it's like, man, it's so plainly clear that you're talking about yourself, but you probably don't even know it. And Oh. It was hard.
That's super valid. And it's funny the parallels to the ICO space too, because there were so many people selling a dream of these huge returns, you know, people like you and I can suddenly become rich if we invest in these tokens early stage. You know, you're selling the dream and then it turns out to be a total, you know, a total fiction.
Right.
So yeah, it's sad, but it's happening in so many different sectors, and, you know, people just have to be super mindful.
Yes, you do. And thank God the internet is there. If you go and look up these things, you know, you can find out if people are, you know, doing things and just over and over, they're doing bad things. If it's the first time and you don't know, and you're one of the first people to get fleeced by a new con artist, then that sucks. You can kind of take that as your admissions fee, you know, but it's kind of your fault if you get scammed by somebody who's been out there doing it for a while. Not all the way your fault, but you need to do your research. So that brings me to one of the most important questions I try to ask every guest, which is for the listeners who are looking for voices and insight they can trust. Is there anyone in the blockchain space that you hold in such high regard you would recommend them without hesitation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the people who I started listening to who really got me interested and excited about the space was Laura Shin of the Unchained podcast. And I know she has a few other related podcasts now too. And I've never met her or spoken to her personally, but, you know, with a journalism background myself, I love the way she conducts interviews, and, you know, she kind of takes no prisoners and asks the hard questions of people. I remember last year there was an interview with CZ of Binance, and, you know, she was pressing him hard on, you know, whether the Binance token was in fact an unregistered security, and, you know, he wasn't super happy about that, and his answers to those questions were just fascinating. So, you know, she's someone who, maybe it's a kind of obvious answer, because I think a lot of people in this industry really respect and look up to Laura, but, you know, especially as a woman in blockchain too, you know, I really appreciate her voice and, you know, everything she brings to the community, so.
Yeah. Good to know. So if you're listening right now, then go check that out. Could you just, it's the Unchained podcast is the one that you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely Unchained. She does have a few in her network now, but that was her original podcast and her most popular.
Good to know. So then that brings me to my next and my personal favorite question, which is, you have a favorite deal story, something where you know, an opportunity or a really good outcome, or you narrowly avoid a disaster, you know, anything that stands out in your mind and offers a lesson to the listener.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even going back, you know, in my career before blockchain, I mentioned that, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to work with a few partners out of Japan to, you know, co-found a software company. You know, these partners had a lot of experience in the hospitality space across Asia. And, you know, getting that opportunity to begin with, it was such a lucky chance. I just happened to be, you know, with the right person at the right table in Tokyo. And it was just such a cool experience being able to go out there and, you know, help sell these big clients like the Ritz-Carlton and the Grand Hyatt, who were initial beta users of the product we created. And, you know, that was just the coolest experience and, you know, so outside anything I had done previously. So being able to be in the room with people like not only the director of rooms at those hotels, who basically, you know, director of rooms apparently controls like everything operationally, but also people like the Bell Desk staff and interns and stuff. That was really cool for me, being able to, you know, as I led sales and product development, being able to, you know, figure out, okay, so what does the Bell Desk staff actually need in a product? And I think that's part of what helped us ultimately close those deals, which were, you know, it took, you know, a month or two worth of, like, you know, several meetings a week to ultimately, you know, ultimately close that. And it really came down to, you know, talking to everyone and taking everyone's input seriously and incorporating that into the product we were building and the pitch to the client.
That's cool. I think I caught you saying in there at one point that it sort of came out of being in the right place at the right time. You're sitting at the right table with the right people. Would you say that that might be the takeaway for somebody who's listening? Apply this.
I hope not, because that's like a really frustrating takeaway, because that's not something you can actually learn from or replicate, really. That's just luck.
Well, to a degree, though, some would say that you create your own luck. And that's one thing I would like to point out.
Yeah.
You ended up in Tokyo somehow, right? Which you met somebody before that, or you saw an opportunity before that. And I think sometimes people who are, because we spent a good bit of time talking about remote and distributed teams, sometimes people, especially the more tech-minded or the introverted types, which I have been at certain points in my life, you tend to get in this frame of reference, like, well, you know, it would take a lot of time and energy for me to leave where I live right now, and conferences are far away, and I don't really feel like sitting on a 12-hour flight. A lot of reasons, but being in the right place at the right time pretty much means you need to spend a good bit of time going places and doing things.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And that's so huge for me. You know, even, you know, before I really started getting into tech and business, I've always, you know, at heart been a traveler. And, you know, that's provided so many opportunities. And, you know, now being in this space with so much happening all over the world, there's always an excuse to go somewhere, like, you know, Malta last year for the big blockchain summit, and, you know, Amsterdam last year, where I was able to speak at the European Women in Technology Conference. So there's always a reason, there's always an excuse wherever you want to go, whether that's, you know, Japan, you know, Malta, Mexico, Brazil, you know, wherever that may be, in whatever emerging market, and being able to meet people there and really get an understanding of that market and, you know, what do they need and how can I actually provide support is huge, and it's made a real impact on, you know, my success, I think.
Absolutely. And it's much like we were talking about at the beginning. There's a kind of culture of people who are internationally minded. They have an international frame of reference. And when you've been doing it long enough, you start to have more in common with these people from all over the world than you do with the people where you're from. And I think that blockchain technology and the adoption of it, even amongst a percentage, a small group of us, is a symptom of that change.
So, yeah, and philosophically, like, all of those things really tie into each other.
Yeah, they do. And so that I want to give you an opportunity now, before we wrap this up, any final words of wisdom based on anything we've talked about that you'd like to share with everybody who's listening right now?
I mean, as far as you said words of wisdom?
Yep.
I would say, you know, take advantage of the opportunity we have with blockchain. You know, it's really opening up so many doors for people all over the world and really closing the gap when it comes to emerging markets and even, you know, the gender gap in tech. And, you know, I think that's something a lot of people say, you know, there's so much opportunity in blockchain. There's, you know, so much opportunity for women to be involved now on the ground floor of this huge industry and help define it and define the narrative surrounding that. But I feel like, you know, there's, people are still just starting to realize that. So, you know, whether you come from a background where you're a technical person or a writer or a marketing person or whatever your passion may be, there's room for you in the blockchain industry. You know, blockchain is something that has the potential to impact you know, every sector. And, you know, I think anyone who's an expert at what they do can find a way to provide value. And, you know, if you're passionate about the idea of decentralization, you know, finding out where you fit in the blockchain space and, you know, just moving forward with that, I think could be really huge for anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that if people have the desire and they've got any skill whatsoever, they can get involved. Even if you're, you know, 16, 17 year old in high school,
yeah,
and you're thinking, what can I do? I don't really know how to do anything. You'd be surprised how much more you know about marketing than a lot of people who are maybe in their 40s or 50s and they've been doing it for a long time and they're trying to keep up with how quickly marketing is changing. So keep yourself involved, to get involved with open source projects if you're in school. Just, you know, if you would point them in any direction, Rhiannon, how can they connect with you if they're interested in learning more about Seafoam, or they just want to get some ideas from you about maybe where they can involve themselves? How do they find you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so our website is seafoam.media. And you can, you know, find out more about me and our team and some of the projects we've worked on and what we do. And I would say, please don't hesitate to reach out to me if you have any questions. I'm on LinkedIn. My email is Rhiannon@seafoam.media. And I'd love to kind of answer questions or point someone in the right direction or potentially collaborate on something. And I know you just mentioned open source projects to get involved with as well. I talked about Green Thumb IO a little earlier, but it is an open source project as well. And Justin's going to be releasing more packages, you know, in the coming months. And there's already people within the last year, you know, playing with the code and starting to do their own DIY projects with it for their own cannabis grows. So, you know, if that's something, if you're interested in like computer vision and machine learning and cannabis or just agriculture in general, definitely check that out. It's greenthumb.io. And I know Justin's always open to, you know, answer questions and help people out who, you know, want to build something like this or who are interested in the technology.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much, everybody. This has been Rhiannon Payne of Seafoam. That's seafoam.media. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much, Colton. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out PendulumInsight.com.